This interview is with Captain Rob Woodard, Tape 1.
I chose to fly in the Navy because from a very young age I was given the flying bug by mother. She was the daughter of a tea planter in Ceylon, taught to fly in Karachi when she was 19. When she was 20, she flew from Ceylon to what is now Bangladesh and back to Karachi in her own Tiger Moth. And from the age of about 9, she took me flying every weekend. And I was at school at Lancing in Sussex and wondering what to do with my life, and went to the Naval Air Station at Ford. By then I'd got a private pilot's license, and I saw the Fleet Air Arm at work at Ford in their Seahawks and Wyverns. And because I adore the sea as well, I suddenly realised that those two things could come together, and I've never regretted a minute of it. It was not my intention to fly helicopters. I joined the Navy specifically to fly fixed wing. But halfway through the flying training, which is the initial stages up to wings, are done with the Royal Air Force, and are still done today with the Royal Air Force. at that time, Linton-on-Ouse in Yorkshire was the base, and one did half the flying training on the Piston Provost and half on the Vampire. And at the end of the Piston Provost stage, one had a couple of weeks off. And just before we left for our holiday, the senior naval officer at Linton-on-Ouse called us in and said that four volunteers were required from our course to try out a helicopter-only pilot syllabus, because they were introducing frontline squadrons of helicopters into the Navy, which had not previously existed, and then looked at all three of us, because by then there were only three of us left on the course. And so I had no option. And I was promised then that if the syllabus worked properly after one frontline tour, which would necessarily be anti-submarine in those days, I could go back to fixed wing, 100 hours in the Sea Vampire at Lossiemouth, and then onto the Seahawk.
What was your feeling about helicopters? What was the general current?
Well, helicopters in those days were very definitely search and rescue machines, the old Dragonfly, flown by pilots who had been injured in fixed-wing accidents, that had broken backs from ejections and things, and therefore weren't medically cleared to eject again, or people who'd simply found life a bit fast and furious in the fixed wing. And so it wasn't a sort of thing that instantly sprung to mind as the answer. Nor, indeed, did sitting in the front of an anti-submarine helicopter in the hover for hours on end, watching periscopes circling you, appeal very much. So from Linton-on-Ouse to Culdrose for the first helicopter operational, basic flying training, with the first course there to do it. And on successful completion, we went to Portland, and there flew the Whirlwind 7 in the anti-submarine role, 12-week course. Most of us fell in the water at least once, because they were very unreliable aircraft. One went in three times. And at the end of that time, we waited to hear which anti-submarine squadron we were going to. And had I not been promised the chance of going back to fixed wing, I think at that time I might have given up, because it was very boring flying to me. And to everyone's surprise, on the very last day, we were all sent to Worthy Down near Winchester, old wartime airfield, where we formed 848 Squadron, which was the first commando carrier squadron for Bulwark, the new commando carrier. I hasten to add that 848 had existed before with helicopters in Malaya, and indeed there had been commando-type organisations such as Suez, but this was the first purpose-built one, Mountbatten's baby. So at Worthy Down, we then commenced our workup prior to embarkation, and I'm talking now about December 1959, and we embarked in January-February time, And so 4-2 Commando, who were the other half of the organization of Bulwark, 848 and 42 Commando, we worked up at Worthy Down doing troop drills day and night, deciding how best the men should jump out, what sort of military position you should take on the ground, how many helicopters you put in one flight to see how many Marines you had at the far end, whether you put the headquarters company down, the headquarters group down in the middle and had rifle platoons on the outsides. All these things were tried. Low-level formation, how best to play it, was it going to be like fixed wing or did we need to do something new, load lifting, the Wombat anti-tank thing they had, we had to lift the barrel with one aeroplane and the wheels with another, and the wheels had to overtake the barrel. And if the wheel aircraft broke down or had an engine failure, then you were left flying around with a barrel asking people where to leave it as most convenient. So it was an interesting time. And then we sailed away, stopped briefly in Gibraltar for a day or so, and then into the Mediterranean. Quite a hurried workup in Libya, near Homs, and we flew into the desert and had mock oil rigs that we had to recapture and things in the sand. And we started to get operational then, in that we were flying low in formations which would land the men on the ground to give them the best chance to come under fire straight away. And that lasted, I suppose, for about a month. And then we sailed on through the Suez Canal to Malaya. So we arrived in Malaya, and we disembarked to Sembawang in Singapore, which was a naval air station, and had only been there a matter of a day or so when the requirement became obvious that we had to submit to jungle training for the aircrew by the Royal Air Force. I used the word submit because, although I was a sub-lieutenant at the time, it came over to me very clearly that the more senior members of the squadron were unhappy about that. And to understand that, you need to appreciate that in the mid-50s, when the Malayan emergency was really on, the Royal Navy were the only helicopters out there. And they had the old Whirlwinds with the American engines, which were very reliable, but considerably more reliable than our own, but they didn't lift very much. And they actually ran out of aircraft in about sort of 56, 57 time. And the Royal Air Force took over with their Sycamores. The Sycamore was not really a frightfully good aircraft for the jungle because it was a low aircraft. If you didn't duck properly, you really could get your head taken off. And thus, it was rather susceptible to undergrowth and things in the clearings. However, because I had never experienced jungle flying before, and because the older members had been actually responsible for teaching the Royal Air Force how to jungle fly, and thus felt it was rather an impertinence to suggest they shouldn't fly operationally until they were given a rerun, it made great sense. And I and two others went up to the Royal Australian Air Force base at Butterworth, near Penang, where the RAF had their main base, to undergo the jungle training, with a remit to ring up every night and see how things were going, so that the older and wiser members of the squadron could work out whether it's worth them coming or not. And we'd only been there a few days when the Sycamores were grounded, because one of them started up one morning and its blades flew off. It was a very dramatic incident, because one of the blades went straight through the authorization hut where one signed the aircraft books for going to fly, which was made of ATAP thatch. Unfortunately, no one was hurt, but it took everyone rather by surprise. And it was discovered that the blades, which were made out of laminated wood and covered in linseed oil, had become mightily attractive to the voracious appetite of the white ant. And so they'd gnawed it away at the root. So they were grounded until metal blades could come. And so whether anyone liked it or not, we were the only operational helicopters in Malaya. So we carried on with the job. And by then, one must say that everything was very much limited to the northern border. And
Sorry, just
I must stress that at that time, and now I'm talking about the spring of 1960, the emergency was within 3 months of coming to an end, and there were pockets of communist terrorists up on the border, just north of where we were, and not very much activity. One used to fly into the jungle forts to resupply them and change people around, and you would find spent cartridges from little incursions the night before. Was rarely as exciting as it got. Although one was flying over areas where the communist terrorists were, and in a machine which quite often left you in stony silence, that kept a young man sort of up to the mark. On arrival in Singapore, literally on our first afternoon, and bear in mind we had come quickly across the Indian Ocean, and we were gathered round the pool in the officers' club at Terra when a message came down saying that there was an urgent requirement for a flight right up country the next day, or as soon as we possibly could, because there had been an accident with a patrol and one of them had been killed, and the patrol commander, in attempting to cut down trees to make a clearing for the helicopter, had been killed himself. And so the patrol were very eager that these bodies were brought out. And we had disembarked on a Friday. So now it was Friday at tea time or something, and we were all absolutely delighted to be in Singapore, a lot of us, for the first time. And so it was a hive of activity. And we pointed out that the Royal Air Force were at Butterworth, but the army said that they found that they were not able to lift these bodies out until the Monday. And obviously you don't want to have dead bodies in the jungle for any longer than you need to, for a variety of reasons. So we planned to take off at dawn, or just before dawn the next morning, and fly the full length of Malaya, because it's right up near the border. Obviously, it was a task. I mean, we were quite happy to take on, because I think that the Fleet Air Arm, by the nature of its being, is a can-do business. We're always invited to do things which our aeroplanes may not necessarily have been previously designed to do, but you make the best you can. I think it's also fair to say at this stage in the game that we are talking about a weekend, and at sea, weekends don't count for much. Sunday does, because you have church on Sunday, but I've known important exercises where Sunday's been put off till Tuesday, so that it wouldn't upset too many people. And so then you have Sunday on Tuesday and start a new week. And I think that's important to say, because obviously we were interested in the fact that the Royal Air Force weren't prepared to lift these people out. But we didn't know why, and it wasn't our business. There was a task and we undertook it. But we did need to involve the Royal Air Force, because we had to refuel three times on the way up, as I recall, certainly Kuala Lumpur, and obviously at Butterworth, which was only about 25 minutes flying time from the scene of the incident. Well, when we rang through late on Friday night saying, can you give us fuel at lunchtime tomorrow, to the RAF, there was an interesting silence. And they said, who are you? So we said, we arrived today, and we're the Bulwark's commando squadron. Oh, well, I mean, we weren't aware you were around. And so we said, well, we are, and we're coming up tomorrow to lift these chaps out who we understand you can't manage. Oh, well, if we'd known you were here, it might have been rather different. This is a bit awkward. So we said, well, awkward as it may be, we're coming up. And so we did. But it indicated, and I think it is important to get it in the right context, that our approach was one of carrying out the job first. We weren't accompanied, we weren't on site for 2 years and all that sort of thing. We were going around doing our business. And so, as I say, Wednesday afternoons for sport and things didn't come much into our diary. When we disembarked after a month at sea, you know, one would have ample time to do all those sort of things. The helicopter, I believe, revolutionized aspects of jungle warfare. A statistic that I was given very soon after I started being involved was that a day's march was well under 5 minutes flying in a helicopter through real jungle. And if you're bashing at prime jungle with a machete and you're flying overhead at 75 miles, 80 miles an hour, that makes total sense. And so we could fly a week's walk in well under an hour. And so it didn't take very much the imagination to appreciate how that actually really started to revolutionize the jungle warfare, where patrols were going in on foot, sometimes to known CT areas, which they'd take days and days and days to get into a good position. Whereby,
just say CT being communist terrorists.
CTs being communist terrorists. And so the early helicopters, I think they probably had a similar performance to the Whirlwind 7s that we produced. They were the Whirlwind, I think the Mark 22 was an American one, and it had a Wright Cyclone engine, and ours had the Alvis Leonides. In the interim, or perhaps that would be offensive to the Royal Air Force, I didn't mean it to be, the Sycamores that they had took a pilot and had a three seats in the back, and they'd take one more man in the front, as I recall. There was one interesting incident they had, because their fuel cocks were between the seats. And, of course, the patrols had Alsatians with them. And your job was to fly the patrols in to a place where they could then start their work, so that it saved them days and days and days of walking, rather like going up Everest. You saved them all that walk up the valley and into sort of Camp 29, so they could make the assault. So you took the patrols to where they could start their work. And after a week, or even a fortnight, I can tell you, these dogs did smell very, very strong. And a dog sat down on the fuel cocks of the Sycamore, which brought it down to the earth with, rather suddenly. And they thought they'd had a major failure, and he'd just turned the fuel off for them. So one learnt masses of amusing and interesting lessons. There were very few people who actually died in helicopter accidents, and there were masses of little helicopter incidents. And there were one or two obvious exceptions to that rule, because if you arrive in the trees with a dead engine auto-rotating, it's in the main about 200 feet to the floor of the jungle. And one of the disappointments is that the jungle foliage covers the hole that you make as you go in. So searching from the air, it's very, very difficult indeed to see where anyone had gone down. And so we developed various things, balloons on long strings, little very cartridges that fired out of a thing rather like fountain pen, which you still have today. The mini flare were developed for Malaya. And anything that you could do to attract attention, smoke. But you wanted to be careful about smoke and other attractions if you were in an area where the communist terrorists were known to be, because you were going to get the wrong side first. The northern part of Malaya, as most of Malaya, is undulating with the very high trees. 200 feet is an average over the proper jungle, and some quite high ridges up to 2,000 or 3,000 feet in the Cameron Highlands and things. And our best method, and the preferred method when jungle flying, of finding your route, because you imagine if you're looking at hundreds of thousands of acres of nothing but green, there are no features. So any tracks, of which there were very few, valleys, so contours, and most important of all, rivers. And we would always fly up and down rivers if we could. Thus, if you had an incident, you were by a river, which would give you a clear sky, usually, and also, if need be, to paddle down. And if there were no rivers and no particular undulations, you flew on a compass course and hoped that nothing untoward happened.
Did you... Story.
Having taken supplies into Fort Kemar, which was fairly near the Siamese border, above Grik, spent the night there and set off the next morning
to recover to Butterworth. And the weather forecast wasn't particularly good, but they thought to get through. And after a short time, the cloud really started to come down until it was forcing us into the tops of trees. And there was obviously no future in flying on like that. And the option was to turn back. But it had closed in behind us. So now, if you can imagine it, the sort of fog, thick fog, down to treetop height. And one had to stop and found a little clearing and went down into it. And not too certain about who might be terribly friendly in the local area, because it wasn't a very big clearing, and there was no obvious sign of habitation. And after a short time, a movement in the bushes, and one thought, oh, you know, this could be rather unfortunate. And out came a lovely old Abu woman with an aluminium teapot, who took one look at us and fled. And a bit later, some of the menfolk arrived and were very cheerful. Well, now, this cloud stayed right down on the treetops, but it was blue above it. And after a time, we could hear these search and rescue people, we imagined, out, the fixed-wing aircraft droning overhead. There was nothing we could do to attract their attention through the 100 or 200 feet of cloud. And we couldn't get them on our wireless. And so we were there for most of the day, and then flew out in the afternoon. And we arrived very cheerful to find a lot of ashen faces, thinking that we'd vanished off the face of the earth. So it was just amusing. The hazards that we faced when flying the Whirlwind 7, first of all, I think the weather is worthy of a mention, because the weather in the tropics is dramatic compared to the climate in this country. You can have considerable heat. The engines didn't like that. Humidity, they didn't like, and nor did the electrics. Everything got terribly, terribly damp. And so wirelesses played up and things like that. And the monsoon. Now, people consider the monsoon as a time of year. One refers to monsoon showers as the sort of showers that you get over the jungle at a time of day, as the reason for the great monsoon drains, an incredibly heavy rain for quite a short time, but the rain bouncing off a road and really quite able to damage rotor blades. It was not a good thing to fly through a monsoon shower. One had to do it occasionally, but it could do damage to the helicopter, quite considerable damage. And the most dramatic hailstorms, if you went up into the bottom of cumulonimbus clouds, very, very bad lightning and hailstones. So weather, a problem. Cloud settling in the very damp, humid times of the day. Heat, which reduced the power available. And thus, in the main, the load one took, on a good day, you could carry up to 6 Gurkhas and 4 Royal Marines. And that was the top. All 4 Royal Marines.
Just say that again, on a good day.
On a good day, you could carry 6 Gurkhas or 4 Royal Marines and their basic fighting equipment, not their large packs. And on a bad day, it was 5 and 3. And I, on one occasion, remember vividly picking up what I considered was a reasonable load in the bottom of a clearing, and again understand that the clearings were just bigger than the helicopter. They weren't swanky clearings at all. You came into them and came down virtually vertically, which is not a good thing for the aerodynamics of a helicopter, because you recirculate your own air and can actually be sucking up disturbed air which comes down through the blades and collapses your lift. So you have to be very, very careful about pulling on power as you're coming down into the clearing. All this recirculating air just makes you go down faster rather than slower. And so there's quite an art to flying vertically down into a clearing through 200-foot high trees, which are just off the tips of your rotors. And if you hit one of those, I mean, it will fracture the rotor blade, so it's very important not to. Although on occasions one cleared away a certain amount of brush with the rotor blades to make more space, usually not intentionally. But I remember sitting for 20 minutes in the bottom of a clearing at high power in the hover till I'd burnt off sufficient fuel to equate to the weight of a man, so I could fly out with my four Royal Marines instead of the three that I would have flown out with otherwise, rather than leaving one man alone in the jungle. That was the option, and you would never do that. It were better that we all stayed and just sat on the ground until I'd got the fuel right down, or that I took out two. And so that was an accepted practice. Burn down your fuel until you'd got the weight to come out, because you wouldn't necessarily know how many men you were going to lift out or what they got with them. Perhaps they had a casualty or prisoners or something like that.
And what about night flying and evening flying? Did you have this problem of some finding yourself having to come back very with the sudden dusks and so on?
Yes. Night flying was not on to clearings unless there was a real emergency. You go into a clearing in the dark to save a life. And we did do that on one notable occasion with two helicopters, and one put its landing lights on to help the other one into the clearing. It's a very risky business, and in fact the hierarchy are not at all pleased at that, because the chances are you'll lose the helicopter, yourself and a medic in the back, and land on top of the people who are hurt at the bottom. It was too difficult, because you simply couldn't judge where you were on a properly dark night. You'd go into little jungle strips in the dark, although, of course, just flying over the jungle in the dark had its hazards, because if one had an engine failure, it's very difficult to work out at what stage to try and slow down before flying into the trees, because your radio altimeter and things would tell you the height of the ground, not the trees. And so we didn't night fly operationally unless it was a matter of saving life. And that was done several times in Malaya and several times in Borneo. But mainly day flying, and trying to keep up to date with the weather and avoid it. Weather was definitely a factor that one had to take very seriously, because it was capable of sudden and violent change. There was one occasion when I was flying back from a jungle fort, having spent the night there, near the Siamese border, and the clouds started to come down. You might say, well, just because you haven't got radar, why can't you go into cloud? You could fly in cloud. There was no difficulty with that. But what you didn't know was the extent of the cloud. And the one thing you mustn't do is to fly into the bottom of a cumulonimbus or something, because they're vast hailstones and incredible updrafts. And they would actually destroy a helicopter. And so one went on underneath it. And little by little, the cloud came down to the top of the trees. And there's no turning back, and there was really no going forward, because one was low down in the valleys and now at treetop height. And I was forced to put down and found a clearing. That's an uneasy feeling, because you don't really know where the communist terrorists are. And quite frankly, by then, I wasn't entirely sure where I was. Because one tree looks very much like the next, and one's trying to avoid them, it's not a good time to look at your map. I knew I was going in the right direction. I was on the right heading. And I just sit it out until the clouds went. And having landed in this fortuitous clearing, I'd been there a few minutes when there was movement. And one wondered whether it was going to be a friendly face or not that appeared. And a dear old Abu woman came walking out of the jungle, wearing not too much and clutching an aluminium teapot. She was very civilized. She hadn't intended to give us tea at that stage. She, I think, was going to the river. And so she fled back into the jungle, and her villagers later came and found us. We heard fixed-wing aircraft droning overhead after a time, and were sure they were looking for us. But we could make no contact with the radio, because we were right down at the bottom of the trees and in the bottom valley. And eventually the clouds cleared and we flew out. And we were very happy that all was well. And it was rather rewarding to see how concerned people had been for our safety when we got back. The way one operated around the forts and taking patrols into clearings, obviously you'd be well away from the main base at Butterworth for some time, and so you would refuel at the forts. So some of your sorties were carrying fuel into them. There's no question they went. The fuel dumps were made by anything but aircraft, helicopters. And so you would be flying fuel tins into a fort for three sorties and then using them to leapfrog you onto another one for another two sorties to finally get to the one that you wanted to at the end, where you could fly in and out of a clearing without refueling, and because it would be unsuitable. So the jungle forts in the main were used as the fueling bases, which we kept topped up. And one knew and had marked on your map where emergency fuel supplies were. And so the example I gave you of sitting hovering in the bottom of a clearing for 20 minutes to burn down fuel to lift another man would leave me short of fuel to get home. I could then divert to someone a bit closer. And you would climb out and fuel your own helicopter from the, I think, 5-gallon drums. They were very, very popular. They were made out of shiny tin. And all the natives adored the empties because they made roofs out of them and cooking utensils. There was a currency in used fuel cans.
And you've got about a minute.
Yes, our job was to carry anybody who needed to within the operational environment, and that included the pregnant Abu women, headmen who wanted to come and discuss things with local commissioners. And so one had assorted loads of different people.
How did they enjoy helicopter rides?
Oh, they just sat there with round eyes, clutching onto anything very nearby. I think it was quite frightening for them, really. But we gave them barley sugars and things, and they were very quickly happy.
Right, this is the end of tape one. I'm sorry to say, I have to go and have another leak. I don't know why, it's too much wine and water. I'm just going to wind this tape. Well, I've got it on tape, never mind.
Fine.
Do you want to disappear as well?
No, I'm happy at the moment.
I'm sorry about this, I can't speak enough.
Not a bit.
That's very nice. That sort of clears the decks for Borneo now.
Right. Yes.